So people who want to ask questions or make brief comments on all the issues that have been raised by Stephen, Nadine, and Rod, please join us at the mic.
Who was watching? I think that needs to be known. That's the real threat. That's the majority.
We don't know the extent to which these things were being monitored, or the you know, the extent of the folks who were doing monitoring. But we do know at this point that an emeritus professor at UIUC, Carrie Nelson, who used to run the AAUP, used to be the head of it, admitted to working with an extreme right-wing blogger by the name of William Jacobson at Legal Insurrection. He runs a website called Legal Insurrection, and the point of Legal Insurrection seems to be to look at all of those liberals in academia who are ruining the world. And they partnered together and created an entire cachet of every tweet that I had been sending, even since before the Israel's invasion of Gaza. So at least those two were watching. Now, what they did with that cachet of tweets, I have no idea. I have my suspicions. I don't know. We don't know. But I do know that there are, you're putting your finger on something important. There are numerous groups in existence whose sole purpose, essentially, is to get pro-Palestine professors fired. I mean, that's why they exist. The Amchai Initiative and, you know, the Campus Watch before that. And now there's something called the Canary Mission that is profiling students for the benefit of future employers so they don't hire these students, which I find, you know, sleazy as hell. It's one thing to target professors, that's bad enough, but really to target students and to put their profiles public as a way of ruining their careers is taking the muck to an entirely new low that I didn't even think these people were capable of, right? The pro-Israel crowd. And so, but it exists in a larger context, we have to remember. There's an entire media industry in existence today that's nurtured by the very idea that white male Christians are the most oppressed species in the universe. And this particular media industry is always on the lookout on social media for its next example of how the academy needs to be defunded and how the government needs to take over and blah blah blah, and it overwhelmingly focuses or targets women of color. Saida Grundy got into a lot of trouble over the summer for what I saw to be perfectly obvious and innocuous tweets, right? Sandria Robinson, and in both cases, university administrators threw them completely under the bus. Deepa Kumar at Rutgers University. And we always see upper administration, they never take up for their professors. They never take up for them. They just say academic freedom at the end. You know, they hem and they haw. You know, and so so it's not just, you know, I guess pro-Israel groups that are doing this. There are entire organizations and media sites that are interested in sort of looking to social media, looking to political essays, looking to talks that academics give in order to generate evidence of our debauched politics and our inability to teach students. And it's part and parcel of a structure of white supremacy in that its primary goal is to sustain the interests of this particular corporate elite. So I don't see Carrie Nelson and others monitoring my tweets and then decontextualizing them and then purposefully misreading them and misinterpreting them as detached from, you know, the latest Fox News report where, you know, about the latest woman of color professor who's doing horrible things to her students. I see it as part of the same pattern, I guess, if that makes sense.
Go ahead.
I have a question for all three of you. You, Ms. Newberg, but when you teach about things so horrible, you know, so horrible, so foreign to some students that may have never heard about these things. How do you get them to engage as a professor? Because I have the hardest time to get them to even just speak their reactions, their feelings.
Thanks for the question, and thanks for coming. Don't really know where to begin. I mean, I guess, I understand the whole world of trigger warnings, et cetera, but I also think people in the U.S., it's such a sanitized reality that a lot of people are living in, despite the fact that a lot of state violence is produced, you know, in our own backyard. And so I kind of believe in just putting it out there and having people, you know, kind of engage directly with some of the most horrific issues of our times, because otherwise I think we're complicit in a lot of the wars and support for settler colonial states elsewhere. And I think it's just important to put questions of students' accountability as people living in the United States, you know, right there on the table. But I hear what you're saying about it being difficult, and I can't really go into it now in terms of strategies, but I use everything from blog posts to interactive exercises, bringing people into the classroom, going into the city or wherever you may be outside of the classroom, and just trying to keep it active, and then create opportunities for each and every student to, you know, be part of that, part of the interactions. And then I think from there, you do that in the beginning of the semester, and the rest of the semester you have everybody interact. So happy to talk to you about that.
I think also Stephen's case is so important in this regard, because there's a pedagogy there too. I mean, there's a lesson there. So many students said he's such a wonderful teacher, but he's somebody who also has strong beliefs. And I think so often we're socialized in graduate school to pretend to not have any, you know, you study all these things in the world, but, you know, it's just ideas, right? It's just academic. I don't care about it. I think that role model, that's a terrible role model for our students. But the two messages are, one, of course you should have an ethical compass, and of course we feel things and we think and believe things about the subjects that we study, about the events in human history that we study, but then we can also be fair and open, and we want to know what you think, right? I mean, that there's not a contradiction there. You don't have to pretend to be, you know, sort of morally dead in order to, you know, in order to also be open and curious and nurturing and generous to your students, that those things can actually go together. And I think there's, you know, that's kind of counterintuitive to a lot of the ways we get trained in academia. Dr. Stovall.
Professor Salai, thank you so much for your work and your bravery in this time. My colleagues, thanks so much for your commentary. As a question, one of the things we were talking about leaning towards the arc of justice and engaging in communities and doing this work in a way that's uncompromising, it's this thing always around, it's never about if they come, but when they come. And yours is an example of when they have come. So in our work with young folks, with students, with families, what are some things that we can begin to do in preparing and training folks for when they come, because we know they're coming?
You know, one of the things, I mean, this also goes to the pedagogical piece, right? You know, just teach people and students, but also our colleagues, you know, the value of collective formations and collective struggle, you know, that when they come, you've already built, you know, the sort of collective infrastructure, you know, to meet, you know, what is coming at you. So it's not you by yourself, right? And our worlds are filled with, you know, these wonderful traditions of how to produce, you know, collective formations, whether they're writing groups, whether they're, you know, the aesthetic groups, whether they're activist organizations. I mean, those are the things that we have to hold on to, because the opposition already has its infrastructure. We've got to make sure that we've got ours. Right? And those are never infrastructures that are, you know, determined or authored by single people. I mean, those are always things that are determined and authored in collectivity, right?
I mean, I think for myself, for working with Arab and Muslim students, and I was at University of Michigan for 10 years, so I'm new here, but one of the issues was always that Arab Americans are not recognized as a, quote, racial minority, but the U.S. Census classifies Arabs as white. And so because there isn't this language of being people of color or et cetera, or minorities, then students don't have the framework and don't have a language set for going to the administration or building a base so that they could be protected for when they come. So we've had to do a lot of work in kind of integrating the language of race into the communities and then working from there on building, like you said, coalitions for when they come. And we just had this victory at the University of Michigan where the students got an Edward Said lounge on campus, which was an outcome of that, of bringing in the language of race into the Arab American communities and student groups. So,
right, I want to second what Nadine and Rod both said. So a lot of people through the years have been picked off for their pro-Palestine advocacy, and I think what illuminates Rod's argument about being prepared is I think sort of played out in this case. So after watching so many of us get picked off over the years, this time we were ready. This time we were ready. This time there was a community built. It largely came out of the original organizing came, the labor came from people involved in various forms of ethnic minority or people of color organizing. U.S. ACME, the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, group that I've long belonged to, organized immediately. So we had we had enough collective power, at least not to let the issue die, to push back, and I think that's hugely important. And I think for anybody who's sort of being prepared for the struggles, either inside or outside the academy, when you're talking about sort of passing down knowledge, it's crucial that they understand that you don't do this work, you can't do this work as an individual. You know, you need comrades not only for, you know, political support, but you need them for emotional support. You know, and we need to continue to find ways. Some people do this really well, some people don't do it so well, but we need to continue to find ways also of working above and beyond our own immediate communities and try to find common languages, you know, that allow us to work across racial and gendered lines, you know, national lines, religious lines. And it's not always easy, but when it happens, that, you know, that kind of work is always worth it.
Yeah, you know, it also reminds me of, you know, when the American Studies Association even broached the discussion about whether or not to support the BDS group. There were plenty of people who were like, this has nothing to do with the association. And that year I happened to be one of the program co-chairs for the community forum and for the roundtable that Stephen was on. So there were plenty of people who were saying things like, this has nothing to do with American Studies. It was important for those of us who thought otherwise and were in American Studies to say, no. You know, for the last 20 years, our critical errand has been the critique of empire. You know, U.S. and other empires, and this is actually part of that errand, right? And, you know, for instance, you know, when I first started teaching American Studies at the University of Minnesota, you know, one of the first, you know, texts that I taught was Edward Said's, you know, Zionism from the standpoint of its victims. And then El Shohat's, you know, Sephardim in Israel, Zionism from the standpoint of its Jewish victims, you know? And so that was in American Studies. It was important for me and others to remind people that this is not an issue that is extraneous to our concerns. Mm-hmm. You know, that this is actually part of our intellectual and our political momentum.
Before the next question, before people leave, I just want to make an announcement that there are folks here from the Smiyawidis Defense Committee, and if anyone wants to get connected and go to Cincinnati for the appeal tomorrow, you can find them outside the back of the room. Just got a note for that.
Go ahead.
Hi, I'm John Wilson. I'm with the Illinois AUP and also co-editor at HumeBlog.org. I wanted to ask Professor Salaya a question about free speech. And I suspect there are some people who have supported your cause who might not have supported a similarly angry pro-Israel professor, either because they wanted to protect Palestinian students or because they recognize that if leftists protect free speech, only leftists end up getting fired. And so I and in many ways, the only way you can get conservatives to defend free speech is to start firing conservatives. And so I wonder what you would sort of say to the idea of the leftists who are opposed to free speech for various reasons, or to free speech absolutists like me. Which of us do you think is wrong? Should progressives protect free speech for everyone, or is free speech a political tool that the left should use?
Thanks, John. It's great to see you. John works on the academic blog, and he's done remarkable work not only around this case, but around many other cases of interest. I mean, I think a lot about the question, and so, you know, you can put free speech, of course, you can analyze it as a legal category, right, as a political / discursive category, and as, you know, and as a set of rights. So I think philosophically, free speech is an easy concept to tee off on and to complicate and to problematize, but, you know, I also take a pretty traditional view that whatever problems that exist with its, I guess the inconsistency of its practice, the same as with academic freedom, right? Academic freedom is inconsistently practiced and applied, and these things are always practiced and applied in conversation with the context, right, in which it becomes relevant, of course. But it's the most useful tool, you know, I guess we have available to us to do this organizing work and to raise these critiques. And in that sense, you know, I find in it a sort of indispensability. I don't like the idea of somebody with a differing political view facing some sort of censure. And, you know, I've kind of been accused over and over, you know, in absentia, you know, of, well, you know, Salida would love to get rid of all the pro-Israel professors. Okay, you know, read what I've said. Tell me where I've ever said that I would support that. I believe at the very least that due process is critical to the practice of academic freedom, and I'm deeply skeptical of administrators reacting to a public outrage using the discourse of student well-being as their rationale. I think that we all ought to be suspicious of that sort of structure. This is a very roundabout way of saying that I would tend more towards, although I would not call myself a free speech absolutist, I would tend more towards free speech absolutism than I would to a type of relativism in which it seems very likely that centers of power could more easily control. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, we could talk about this for a long time. I think, you know, there's a sort of a yes or a way to ask a yes or no question around an issue that is so fundamentally complex that there is not a yes or no answer. And I'm always uncomfortable when we decontextualize the power embedded in who gets the right to speak and who doesn't. I mean, the reality is that people who are who embody a great deal of power and who speak for the elites of this country are not being fired and silenced. And so, you know, so to impose a kind of false symmetry on our experiences and our relationship to power distorts the nature of this supposed freedom that we all have as, you know, kind of free roaming individuals, right? We all have a relationship to the centers of power that determine the consequences of free speech. You can say, anybody in this room can say what they want to say, but if you're an untenured you know, adjunct professor, and you get up and say something that all the people that vote, they have a lot of discretion to vote on whether you get a job next year or not. Yeah, in abstract, we all have free speech here, right? But the consequences of that speech are very different. So I just want to, I know the spirit of your of your questions, all fair and good. But I just want to just warn us against, you know, oversimplifying complex questions about power and freedom. Freedom always exists in a context, and it always exists on a continuum. And so false symmetries are, you know, very dangerous things when we talk about issues of power and freedom in this society and in any other. Yes?
In your book, such as on this issue, where you note that the wives and the other officials start addressing you as an employee,
yeah,
rather than a faculty member,
yeah,
which suggested that they would apply academic freedom to a faculty member, but not to mm-hmm. the employee.
Yeah,
can you say?
It's complex. Their use of vocabulary in different moments. Bespeaks a tenuous commitment, right, to the performance of academic freedom. But when they refer to me as an employee, as they did in the very beginning, I feel like it's simultaneously for degrading my place in the university structure, but at the same time not fully disavowing me, you know, from my affiliation there. But they mention me even in the same breath, faculty member and employee. But it is interesting that I think when they use terms like employee, I think it is a bit of a signal or a dog whistle that, this isn't somebody who should be privy to academic freedom, faculty members stronger in that way.
But you know, we had, and I think Rod and I had this conversation too. It's partly an issue of academic freedom, but as I tried to say in the introductory remarks too, it's actually an issue of freedom of expression because you weren't in a classroom, you know, you weren't on the clock. I mean, it raises these questions that a whole bunch of people who write about the university, including Rod, raise about the kind of professionalization of intellectual work, and what does it mean to get socialized to be an academic? It means you have to behave a certain way on or off, like you're always on the, you know, it's like the afterlife of slavery, right? It still goes, you know, they own you and they own what you say all the time. So I can't say whatever I want when I'm off the clock. I mean, that's what it implies. It implies that you have no civilian life, and a compromised citizenship as a trade-off for inclusion in the club.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the thing. Because
we say a lot of things off the clock.
We say a lot of things off the clock. But also, it's not only that you have no civil life, but because you have no civil life, the university can encroach on all parts of your life.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
But it only rewards certain parts of our labor that
exactly
that it endorses. So you know, you can count my tweets against me, but I ain't never put my tweets, you know, in my merit race file.
Right.
You know what I
mean?
I just had 10,000 tweets up on my CV. It kind of authorizes some sort of.
Right. If your tweets are then part of your professional life, because there is no such thing as a civil life, mm-hmm. you ought to be able to get credit for your tweets.
You paid for those tweets.
Instead, you get punished for being an activist. You know, if you're doing, but you don't get punished if you're going to the opera on the weekend.
Right.
Other questions, thoughts? Yes.
Professor, it's really good to see you. I really believe you're going to prevail in your lawsuit. It's, I know it's generated a lot of attention, but it's pretty simple. You relied on it to your detriment. That's kind of basic contract law. So, frankly, you should win. I mean, that's pretty elemental. But I think what people need to realize is some of the level of the people who are organized against you. One of the big trustees who was against you was, I don't know if people know who Patrick Fitzgerald was, but he is a former prosecutor. He's a powerful man. And also, people need to understand, when it comes to the criminalization of political Muslim life, he is certainly one of the people who is very much behind that. One of the speakers spoke of the Holy Land 5 case, and also the 96 case with the Patriot Act and the recent rulings with material support regarding freedom of speech, and the 96 ruling regarding that is no longer valid with pretty much with the Holy Land Five decision, among others.
Yeah. No, that's an interesting connection. I know that Fitzgerald, Nadine, others might know more. I know that he's been involved in some of these prosecutions of Palestinians, hasn't he?
Yes, and other people who are here from the community might know more about.
You want to make a comment in the mic?
Sorry. No, I mean, people should know that there were a whole series of activists in this town, including some of them with U of I connections, who their homes were raided by the FBI. And it was Patrick Fitzgerald's work. He led up that witch hunt. And they still are not off the hook in terms of that. This grand jury could be enacted against these activists once again. This is for pro-Palestinian solidarity work and in solidarity with other struggles around the world.
Thank you.
Yes. And if people, I think people over here are having trouble hearing, so speak into the mic, if you will.
Okay. I just wanted to switch to the Palestinian question in the Middle East today. That seems to be such a stalemate and oppression and just a horror. And I just wanted to get your views about where you see any possibilities of some opening to something different.
Okay. I'm not very wonky politically, so I don't have any I don't think any special insight to the political process there, but I do believe that the ways we traditionally think about this issue or conflict are pretty narrow in terms of relating it to what a notion of Palestinian freedom or liberation might look like and how that might occur. In other words, I pretty much abjure the just reject the framework of a U.S.-led peace process. We've been mugging around in that, you know, for 40, 45 years now. It's clear that that's not going to work. I don't rely on, you know, the EU or NATO. So people will say that I'm being deeply unrealistic. But based on the evidence, it seems to me at least equally unrealistic that the status quo is going to produce anything other than continued Israeli colonization. There's no evidence otherwise. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is the project of ending the conflict, which I would call Palestinian liberation or Palestinian decolonization, is necessarily in profound conversation with the decolonization of the centers of power that are invested in Israel. Right? So we to talk about the liberation of Palestine, we also have to talk about the liberation of indigenous communities in North America. We have to talk about, you know, the inequitable structures of U.S. late capitalism. We have to talk about the continued state violence and both formal and de facto modes of segregation practiced against black communities in the United States and elsewhere. All of these, what I'm trying to say is there's a particular force of power that's invested both directly and indirectly in the colonization of Palestine, and it's very hard for me to imagine those centers of power being destabilized enough to produce the sort of opening you discuss, right, without the sort of collective action that's attuned to various forms of liberation simultaneously. This is not, it's easier to talk about than to practice, but thinking about what it means to liberate a community from settler colonization means that we have to think seriously in ways that supersede the limits that neoliberal logic impose on us. We have to be more creative than the nation state. We have to be more creative than the institutions that profit from these things. And so to me, liberating Palestine is in a way, I don't know if this makes it harder and easier, but I think it makes it more real. It's a project of global liberation in lots of ways.
I'm rarely the glass half full person, but I just want to also say, you know, going back to something you said earlier, you know, when I think Dave Stovall asked the question of how do communities prepare for attacks, and you said when you felt targeted that there had been work done and people were ready to speak out. And I think there are many cases where people were attacked and went down quietly, and there wasn't a pushback, and there wasn't the kind of visible support that your case has received. So I think that says something. I'm hoping that means something, you know, about a shifting terrain. I think also we've seen, you know, cracks in the mold of silence around criticizing Israel, and including in the Jewish community, you know, Jewish Voices for Peace and others that have spoken out in ways that were pretty unimaginable not that long ago. So I have to see, you know, I also think of the connections with Black Lives Matter. I mean, Black Lives Matter delegation went to Palestine, and those young people get the connection. We had the panel Ferguson to Palestine at the ASA. And a lot of really good discussion. So, you know, the resolution is complex. The resolution of all the systems of oppression we find ourselves mired in is very complex. And, you know, I don't see a simple solution, but I do see movement in hopeful directions, I guess I want to say.
Phrase entry not approved. I keep thinking of an immigrant or an asylum seeker to the United States and how that could be stamped in their passport, and the bureaucratic way in which the university relates to its employees. And so I was thinking, switching away from that, if you wouldn't mind telling us about the very real human consequences of that, like what happened to your family after, you know, you got the letter.
Oh boy, well, you just invited me to bore everybody to death. I'll try to keep it brief for you. I guess what strikes me about the entry not approved, it's utterly impersonal and technocratic. It doesn't ascribe any agency to the disapproving body. Right? It's just not approved. It happens, right? And it's just. And I think about it in relation. I didn't write about it in the book, but in relation to, you know, like in the press in the early months, Christopher Kennedy kept referring to me as that fella, yeah. You know, that fella. It's just like, you know, people. I'm not an egomaniac. I have a name.
Yeah.
You know, like I have emotions. I have and Phyllis Wise at one point sort of talked about me as if I were like a pet. I can't remember what the exact phrase was, but, or maybe it was Kennedy. We didn't want to harm the fella, and, you know, and, oh, we wanted to do the humane thing. Yeah. As if they were going to be asleep. You know what I mean?
That's
how
people
know
those emails, too.
Yeah, exactly. And so I mean, it's just the humane thing, and I don't know. It's very difficult. I don't care what anybody says. And I'm going to speak for other people who have been publicly, criticized or smeared. But in my opinion, right, based on my experience, it's extremely difficult to fully tune out all the noise. It's hurtful. It hurts. And you're dealing with, you know, it hurts being rejected and to be rejected so publicly. And everybody knows why. And then, you know, every jackass with a keyboard is close reading my tweets, and it's just weird, you know. And it's like, well, you're discussing a human being as if the human being were an issue, but I don't feel like an issue. I feel like a human being feels, you know. So there's always this disconnect, and it's really taught me the importance of thinking very closely about how we tend to invest, or how we're trained our entire lives to invest our notions of safety and empathy and being into institutions, and not to the humans that comprise them or interact with them or suffer from them. And so I feel like the process of going to Beirut was it was transformative, in that it was I think healthy to move away from the United States and start working in a place that, like any elite private university anywhere in the world, has tons and tons of problems, but criticizing Israel happens to not be one of them. So that change, has been good. I think it's been good for my family, but at the same time, I've missed my parents. My kid misses his cousins and his uncles and aunts. So there's definitely a downside to having to pack up and move to another country. But it also gives me, I think, enough credibility to hammer home the point that these notions of American exceptionalism around speech and academic freedom and civil rights is nonsensical and hypocritical. So everybody, oh God, he had to go to Lebanon, ha ha ha, he's going back with his terrorist friends, and all this Orientalist nonsense. It's like, dude, don't give me this exceptionalist bullshit. I went to the Arab world to get free speech. Some people have to do that, so you need to check yourself and your notions of the U.S. as being the be-all, end-all, and the only place in the world, right, where people can survive and exist. We're not as backwards as you make us out to be, and so I'm still sort of working through these different, transatlantic relationships, if that makes any sense.
In contrast to the way that Stephen describes feeling about how the university was treated you not as a human. There was a very touching part that you wrote about your son when you were very upset, and you said, he said, "Are you okay, Papa?" And you had to say, "Yes, I'm okay," which, of course, at that moment you weren't okay, but this empathy from a young child and, adults who are supposed to have some, civility, to use that awkward term, were really not treating you as a human being. Last question.
I wanted to ask you a question about contradictions of our institution of U of I, right, broadly. And the contradiction that I'm feeling affectively, that I'm so excited you're here in Chicago, and I'm also feeling so such melancholy to think about what it would have been like to have you as a senior colleague in the U of I system. And I think so many people would have benefited from you being here, so I want to say that publicly. But the contradiction I want to ask you about is the one between the hyper-visibility of dangerous knowledge in the academy, right? And the fact that now we have all these other modes of monitoring, right? And the gross inadequacy ineligibility of what we're doing at the same time, right? So I think it's not incidental that the people who sponsored your talk here are all the interdisciplinary units on this campus, right? And many of the interdisciplinary units at UIUC who were very much involved in organizing and supporting your work, who were thinking creatively about what knowledge projects could look like in the academy, were excited about having you be their colleague. And then that work is not only illegible, right, to our friends in administration, but seen as something that's dangerous and that also needs to be stamped down. And that there is that increasing, intensifying contradiction. So the question I have is, what happens to the space of our institution, of our universities, to do the kind of scholar activist work that we've been talking about all night? You haven't abandoned it. You had to have an exilic moment over there in Beirut, right, in order to continue that work. But what happens to the university? What happens to our space, that infrastructure feeling that Rod is talking about, that we're all collectively growing, when there is all this, inability to see and recognize what we're doing?
That's a terrific bit. I think we should each provide us an answer to that.
Yes. That'd be a nice closing for all three of you. Yeah.
It's a terrific question. I think it's a great note to to end on? Well, depending on the quality of our answers. let me position your question more specifically into the context of the American Indian Studies program to which I was hired. It gives me an opportunity to do that, and I hate it when an event has passed and then I realize we didn't spend enough time talking about the location of my hiring and firing. I feel like this type of repression that so many people are pushing back against enriches us in lots of ways at the level of ideas and theoretical possibility, but it's also deeply threatening to our ability to collectively survive as communities dealing with dangerous knowledge in these institutions, especially as they grow increasingly privatized, especially as they grow increasingly reliant on donors and their whims. So I think about the place of, say, the American Indian Studies program at UIUC, where the Native population isn't huge, but it's there, where the hideous Chief Illini Wet has been retired, but not really, where he continues to be ubiquitous, where my colleagues in that program, and I don't care where they end up or where I end up, I'll always very proudly call them my colleagues because they've been absolutely phenomenal. They're phenomenal human beings who don't deserve all the nastiness that they've had to deal with. See, so not me who's just dealt with this kind of nonsense, the amount of anti-Indian racism that we've been hearing is extraordinary. And a lot of it is implicit, but it's there. Every time, you know, that hearing Nelson opens his loud mouth about how they didn't conduct the hiring process correctly, right? He's putting together, an entire plethora, right, of racist assumptions, right, as are others. So, what is their role in the universities? I think from an administrative point of view, they're there to be celebrated as yes, pun intended, a feather in the cap of diversity. And I think that those who people that program are there for a very different reason. I think they're there to do a very different kind of work and to raise a very different sort of analysis. And when those two impulses come into conflict, and they're always coming into conflict in these so-called marginal fields, it's the impulse towards moderation and tokenization that tends to prevail. I guess I thought a lot about the issue of pro-Israel pressure coming to bear in this particular context, and I think the easy way to think about it is that despite all of the anti-Indian racism that exists, the department was always able to withstand it and survive, but it couldn't withstand and survive this particular form of pressure. But I'm increasingly unsatisfied with that seemingly obvious explanation. I think what was the breaking away point was the fact that so many liberal Zionists don't see themselves as supporting a form of colonization, and in conjoining a critique of Israel's settler colonization with a critique of U.S. settler colonization, they're forced to confront a certain sort of complicity in this act of colonization that they had so far been able to elide. But there's a moment at which our work can become successful enough to push people into a certain sort of recognition, but ironically, it's the moment of that recognition where it tends to get shut down.
I mean, I would just add broadly, for me, what I think before the Salaiti case, so, I mean, after September 11th with the second Intifada, you had more awareness about Palestine generally. I mean, especially in progressive circles, people were more aware that they need to be consistent in their critique of colonization and their commitment to social justice. They need to be consistent and take a stance, you know, in support of Palestinian self-determination. And then what happened as the BDS movement grew, in my opinion, is that the framing of BDS, I mean, I'm a huge supporter of BDS, but one, I think, limitation of it, and maybe it worked for a certain time as a strategy, but now we need to rethink or expand this, is that it focused primarily on Palestine as this place far away where there are these indigenous people, and we're in solidarity with these indigenous Palestinians in this place far away who are being oppressed by Israeli settler colonialism. So you have these rich and important comparisons with like Native Americans and Palestine. But the problem with that, while it was so important because it led people who might support Native American, you know, self-determination, sovereignty to be get that this is similar. But the problem with it is that it sort of erased the context of U.S. imperialism, that one, the main home of Zionism is the United States. And so for many people who, you know, many people who were targeted by Zionism here for decades were kind of left out of that BDS movement and what it was supporting. And so what Stephen's case did is that it kind of, I think, exposed more urgently than anything ever did before that, you know, let's say for academics, you know, what about, you might be supporting BDS, what about your own university, what about your own hallway on your campus, what about your, you know, your colleague in the office next door who nobody knows, but they just got, you know, their entire reappointment committee resigned from their appointment committee because they held an event on campus on Palestine, or they are not getting tenure, no one knows about it, or they know but they're remaining silent. So what I think Stephen's case did is it brought a transnational anti-imperialist framework to the way that a lot of people are thinking about being in solidarity with Palestinian self-determination. So that was more like abstract, but I think I've seen that. I think it gave, on our campus and beyond, it just gave people more, you didn't have to be isolated in a corner. You could now talk about what's going on, and people would sort of now understand it. So.
You know, for me, the thing that is really brought home in your question is the research clusters, the hiring clusters, you know, that for folks in the audience who don't know, there was a hiring cluster initiative that was pretty grand and pretty historic that folks in this room, you know, were the authors of. And that was to really transform this university based on categories that you never see. And you just never see categories like hiring in Middle East and Muslim. You don't see categories like we're going to hire in intersectional feminism. We're going to hire in social justice. We're going to hire in race and disability. You know, we're going to hire in visual culture. You never see those kind of hiring camps. You see things like, you know, 19th century British literature. You know, you see things like demographer. You know, you never see those kind of categories, right? So part of the historic nature of that dream was that it was going to be the first time in the history of the American university that a public institution, and a public institution with working class and immigrant student body, was going to transform itself based on interdisciplinary categories that no other university, you know, had proposed. And so, you know, Nadine and I and other folks in this room, you know, we came, you know, to this university because of that initiative. You know, so one of the questions I've been living with, and one of the things that it evokes for me, your question, you know, is that sort of line from Langston Hughes, like, what do you do with what happens to a dream deferred? You know? And, you know, because in many ways, you know, we're in the moment of these deferred dreams, right? So what do you do with that? You know, more and more as I sit with the question, my answer is, even though I don't necessarily like what it means in terms of my day-to-day, is that you hold on to the dream. You know? So that's my answer.
On that note. Want to thank Stephen Salida, thank Nadine Neighbor, thank Rod Ferguson, Thank all of you for coming out for this.